Welcome to Some Dare Call It Conspiracy with Brent Lee and Neil Sanders. This is the Manchester Arena Bombing on Trial series. On the 22nd of May, 2017, Salman Abedi detonated a bomb in the foyer of the Manchester Arena at the end of an Ariana Grande concert, killing 22 people and injuring hundreds more. A conspiracy theory claiming that this bombing was hoaxed and everyone involved was a crisis actor soon became a dominant narrative in the conspirasphere. One of the main proponents of this theory is Richard D. Hall. Over the course of this series, we will be examining the claims made by Richard D. Hall, as told in his book and documentary, Night of the Bang. Please be aware, this series will be examining a deadly bombing, and we will be discussing details of death and injury. Listener discretion is advised. This is part 5.
Now, I can sense that we've not quite killed you as hard as we did with the Pizzagate one.
That was very convincing.
Well, I mean, the thing with this is it's still rather queasy-making because basically, like, we are talking about children.
Deaths.
Yeah, and dead children.
No, okay. I've found that hard to get past.
Now, Richard would contend, and there may be something to this, that that is the mechanism by which the investigation is thwarted because that's why they would do it like this. But he's being pilloried because people say, you're doubting that children are dead. You're accusing bereaved parents of lying.
Tiny coffins, man. Tiny coffins are fucked up. You see them and they're no good.
Yeah, exactly. This is the thing. And so basically, like, his argument would be that, well, of course you think I am a monster. They've set it up so that you think that I'm a monster, so that you don't give any credence to this. But if you'd actually look at the evidence, you would see that the evidence is very strong, which is why we've given him the chance to look at the evidence and really go over it. And I don't think we've missed anything. I say we looked at the film, we looked at the book, and we looked at his most recent piece of evidence. So
I feel like you've been fair because you've read the book.
Yeah.
You know, like you've given us what I think is right. Like, you know, like...
You can see all the highlights, all the highlighting. I've literally, like, gone through every single page of this book.
Like uni textbooks. I'm sure you fully invite the author to debate you in this situation if seen fit.
Well, here we go. Here's a spoiler. Okay. He did, kind of. Because we're going back to the start now.
Okay.
Now, we mentioned Panorama Show right at the beginning and Disaster Trolls. Panorama is a BBC television show that...
I've heard the podcast, but I haven't seen the TV show.
The TV show is more succinct, and to be fair, they actually used my words completely out of context to say something that I didn't say and that I say the complete opposite of on the radio show. And I was particularly annoyed. And when it happened, I phoned up Mariana Spring and literally shouted at her down the phone and says, you've made me look like I've said something that I didn't. She sort of explained that it was for narrative structure and time and stuff like that. And I thought, all right,
which
fine.
They do, yeah.
Fair enough. Because it's not anything that was untrue. It's just that I didn't say that. Now, there's several things
fair enough
about the Panorama show, right? Because the Panorama show was where basically Richard found out about this. And he thinks that the BBC is persecuting him. He thinks that the BBC is after him in order to silence him and shut him up. And that's not the case. Originally, the Panorama show wasn't even supposed to be about Richard. Originally, it was supposed to be about Brent.
Well, not exactly about me, but about the people who have, like,
come out.
No, it was,
you know, disaster trolls.
Yeah.
Well, disaster trolls, like people who
trolls, yeah.
have been in touch with, basically, people who have been involved in terror attacks and stuff like that. And because of my involvement in the 7/7 conspiracy theory and talking to Paul, a survivor of 7/7, like, we had a good little chat, and basically, it's supposed to be about many different people. And the series, like the podcast series, is about a few different people. You know, so it's about us, the 7/7 thing, about the London Bridge attack, was it?
Yeah.
I think they had that in there and just like all that sort of stuff, you know. But like, okay, should I tell the story of how it actually happened?
Yeah, go for it.
All right. So I'd been kind of talking back and forth with Mariana here and there, just like kind of nothing important, you know, just like liking tweets here and there, whatever. And then the 7/7 anniversary came around and I spoke to Paul on Twitter. She was posting about this new series. She's looking into like investigating what I just said. So I sent her our little interaction with Paul. Because of that, she got in touch with me and said, right, we'd like to get your story and we'd like to, you know, if possible, would you be interested in sitting down and having a chat with Paul, this survivor of 7/7? And I was like, absolutely, yeah. I'm happy to talk about my story and I would absolutely, I'd be honored to speak to this man. Like if he wants to speak to me, I'll absolutely love to speak to him. So there was talks of flying us out to Ireland where he lived, but we just decided to do it on Zoom. So we had a sit down for about an hour and a half, talked over Zoom. Both of us kind of gave our interviews to her. And that essentially, everything that was cut in there was used for the Disaster Trolls episode. Now, during this, when I was talking to her, she asked me a few times about Richard Hall. And I said, yeah, I wasn't really into what he was, you know, talking about. I was doing my own sort of ritualism, false flag sort of stuff. But I knew that you know Richard.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, I'm going to go tell Neil that they keep mentioning Richard Hall's name. So after the interview, I went off and I spoke to you, Neil, and I said, hey, she keeps mentioning Richard Hall. Should I get back in touch with her and tell them like your connection?
Yeah.
Because my whole point is going onto there to show that conspiracy theorists aren't monsters, that we actually just like care about the world. And that's, but we're good people being led by bad info.
Yep.
Yeah.
Bad intel.
You know, and that's what we're trying to do on the show. That's what me and Neil have been trying to show a lot, like who by who we are.
Yep.
You know, so I said, you need to go on there and show them that he's a man, not a monster.
Mm-hmm.
What do you reckon? And you were like, yeah, let's do it, do it.
Yep.
So I got in touch with them again, back in touch with Mariana, and I was like, hey, Mariana and Ant, her producer. And I was like, you guys do know like my podcast host was friends with Richard Hall.
Mm-hmm.
He's practically the reason why Neil wrote books.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, really? Yeah. So I got you guys introduced.
Just to jump in and interject, what happened in some context, right? Okay. The reason that she'd suddenly heard of Richard Hall was because she'd been contacted by Martin Hibbert. Martin Hibbert was basically bringing this lawsuit. So it wasn't the BBC going after Richard. They didn't even know who Richard was. They heard of it from the lawsuit. And at the same time, at the very same time, Alex Jones got stolen for $1.5 billion with Sandy Hook. And so the press had all started saying in the newspapers, not the BBC, the newspapers were prepping this. Richard D. Hall is the UK's Alex Jones. This is the UK's Sandy Hook. Okay. So Mariana Spring and Anne took me out for a beer in the center of Nottingham. And they says basically, look, this is what we're going to talk about. And they made it absolutely clear to me that basically, if you don't give your opinion on Richard, there will be nobody to defend him. And I says, but I don't agree. I don't believe in crisis actors. I think his Manchester thing is completely flawed. And they says, well, it's up to you. And I says, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I will make it clear that I don't agree with him, but I will try and explain to you where I think he's coming from. And so if you actually go to that episode, I think the very first thing I say is, look, a lot of people will say this is monstrous, this is terrible. What Rich has done here is he's a terrible person, and he just isn't. What he's done, like, is massively insensitive, and I don't agree with some of his tactics, but he is not himself a terrible person. And like I said earlier, he thinks that he's Woodward and Bernstein. He thinks that he's perpetuating this sort of thing. And so to be fair, the Disaster Trolls radio show is very fair. It gives Richard, it humanizes him and right, makes it clear. Even though I don't agree with it one at all, I still was defending him, right? And the Panorama show doesn't do that at all. It's just like it's a hatchet piece. It just goes to shows him as a terrible person. But the takeaway is that two things. One, Richard is not being persecuted by the BBC to silence him and shut him up. And do you know how we know this, other than that we were involved in that particular program, me specifically as his defense? Because there's other things that they could destroy him about. You know, if they really wanted to destroy Richard's reputation, they could talk about his opinions on Joe Cox, or even his opinions on Madeleine McCann. I'm not saying whether that's a good investigation or not. Do you know what I mean? If they wanted to destroy Richard, they would talk about loads and loads of things. Now, are they getting probably a bit of glee, and are the newspapers going, oh, amazing, we'll run with this story because it's really, really sensational. We'll paint him as an absolute bastard because it sells. Yes. And did what he did with the filming of people and stuff like that, is that wrong?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It is. And yeah, here's the strange thing. Right, okay, I'll get this right off my chest, right, okay. I've had arguments with so many people about this. First off, they go, no, he didn't do that. And then there was, like I said, he did. It's in his film. It's literally in his film. He filmed a child at her own house without her permission. And they say, well, all right, but it's justified because I think that she's lying. I said, well, I think you're lying. Can I set up a camera in your bathroom? And furthermore, this is the one that nobody ever answers. I say, imagine it was your daughter. Imagine mm-hmm. you went outside and there's a man in his 50s sleeping in his van with a camera set up to film your teenage daughter while she's in her own home.
No.
After trauma.
Yeah.
After a traumatic event. Cops, police immediately. 100% police. No question, police.
But this is the point. Like, people are so driven that they lose perspective and they will do terrible things. And furthermore, his fans will justify terrible things because they want to be contrary or different or whatever. And you can do both, you know, just like I did. I like Richard, but I think what he's done here is massively, massively wrong.
And very thorough, to be fair. I'm still impressed by how thorough it's been. He hasn't been lazy. And that's what I'm impressed by. He has not been lazy. And also kind of tone deaf and offensive has been the thing that's been, I've been quiet about it, but I've been annoyed by it through this whole thing, which is that you can be very, very granular and very detail-oriented, but you can also not be a prick about it.
Yeah, this is the strange thing. Like, there would be ways and means of achieving the same thing without setting up a hidden camera. And stuff like that. Do you know what I mean? Like,
on kids, on children, bro. I would never do that. I just wouldn't do it. I wouldn't think about doing it. Oh.
There were several things. When I first watched the film, right, okay, there were several things that made me just go, oh my Christ. The bit where he set up the camera, there's also a bit in the film where he just shows all the pictures of the dead and injured. And he puts them into categories of like, these are abroad, these already died, these are things. And it's just like, imagine if that was your mom or daughter or whatever, and you're watching them.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
You're just now an Excel spreadsheet column.
Yeah. And latterly, when I rewatched the film and he accused Safi Roussos's mum of accidentally killing her a few days before the concert and covering it up, that made me think that wasn't on either.
Well, I've been very relaxed about the fact that like it was a really good thing, and I think it's really important to be comprehensive. And before on the other episode where it was like, okay, here are all the deaths and here are the stories, I can't help but to be connected to the idea that there is a dead person behind that. And it's been a long journey through this whole thing.
Uh-huh.
But we need to, you know, we're keeping everything, we're keeping humanity. But man, they really are. Like, the fact that you can just exploit death, it's a next level thing to be able to do. It's sociopathic. What's happening here is sociopathic.
Yeah. This is the point. Again, it's a lack of perspective to the point of being offensive. Like, yeah. Right, but anyway, let's go through the evidence and see what it is. Because, like, you know, let's not get caught up in our feelings, because as I said, like that's the sort of the point, isn't it? Like, that's the mechanism by which these things like are not investigated.
I didn't know shit before I came into this. So honestly, I'm going to keep an open mind until the end.
Right. So let's start off with, so we go back into the film. If you remember, we started off by showing strategic operations And strategic operations is, it's a real thing. So it's a crisis actors thing. They do that. They use the medical things and stuff like that. Do you know what they also do? They train proctologists. So by Richard's logic, I never had a finger up my arse that time. That's the logic, isn't it? If there's a training scenario for it, it can't happen in a real world situation.
Oh, because they do that for med students.
Yeah. And it forgets the point that the training scenario is because these things do happen in real world situations. And just because there is a training scenario that copes with this does not mean that every time it happens in the real world, it's a training scenario. Because that's just not how it works.
It's a very similar thing for Event 201, right? Like before the pandemic, where they had the whole Bill Gates funded Event 201, predicted a pandemic. And the thing was terrifying because, to be honest, when it came down to COVID, I didn't realize we were going to have a whole generation of people who were like, diseases aren't real.
Yeah.
Event 201 did say that. And I get that was very, like, you know, prophetic. But it's also the fact that some sociologists saw this shit coming from miles away because that's their field.
I said this on Iconic, and it miraculously it didn't make the final cut of the episode. They were talking about Event 201, and I says, well, yeah, but by that logic, that means that it was the fire brigade that burned down my school and not me.
Yeah.
Because they would turn up every single month to tell us that there might be a fire. And then there was a fire. And it couldn't have been me because I wasn't the one turning up every month to tell people that there might be a fire.
Yeah.
Yeah. I must say, I love the bomb drills and things at my school. That was great because you got a period, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You got to go outside.
Yeah, exactly. And let's face it, outside in your country might not be great, but outside of my country, 9 months a year, pretty sweet.
So nice.
It was really pretty good. But that's a thing there, man. Like it jilt of reality, and sometimes you just got to slap yourself in the face just a little.
I mean, come on, let's get real. Like you said, every single person listening right now, you have done multiple fire drills when you were at school.
Yeah.
Multiple ones, like in preparedness of it, so that you know what to do when it happens.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a basic reality.
Yeah. Right, so going on, he then presents David McCowan and basically says that we know that these things happen because the Boston bombing was fake. And it's like several things, right? One, bollocks. No, we don't know that the Boston bombing is fake, right? Okay,
no, we don't.
Is such an incredible leap. Like, there might be some people that believe it is, but it's by no means been proven, right? And furthermore, that's a completely separate country.
Yep.
It's like saying, oh, there was a beheading in Saudi Arabia. That means that the police behead people in the UK. No, they don't. You can't say that. This is a thing, therefore this thing must always also be that thing. No, it doesn't work like that. And again, what you're doing there is you're throwing shit on the wall and hoping that some of it sticks, essentially.
It's a false equivalence.
Well, yeah. Again, he started from the position of, we know it's fake. How are we going to bolster this case? So anyway, he goes on explaining the official narrative and basically he says, we've not seen any footage that shows what has happened or where everyone was standing at the time. Well, we have actually. It's been in newspapers now. There is the footage of people stood around and Salman Abedi in the actual foyer before it went off. Now, the inquiry did actually show quite a lot of footage, but here's the thing. He says, why has it not been released? Why have these images not been released, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And there's several reasons. One, it's a bomb site full of dead children.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, I've been holding my tongue the whole time.
Yeah.
Full of kids. Full of kids, man. Ariana Grande. If you're under 12, fair enough. If you're over 12, you're a chaperone. Come on, man.
Well, this is the thing. And like, you just go to the BBC guidelines, which we got. And it says that we must take care that our journalism does not put individuals at the risk of harm or cause unnecessary distress. We must consider our tone and language after reporting matters involving loss of life and human suffering. Some of our audience will have relatives or friends directly involved. We should avoid causing unnecessary offence whilst also ensuring that we continue to convey the reality of events and do not unduly sanitise our reporting. We will ensure, as far as is reasonably practicable, that next of kin do not learn of a relative's death or injury from our content. There must be strong editorial justification for the use of very graphic pictures. That's why we haven't seen pictures of dead children.
Absolutely.
And it's also written by lawyers. That's lawyer speak. And not only is that lawyer speak, but it's smart lawyer speak. Because you know what? There are multiple layers to that. You do not want to see children scattered across daytime television. The BBC is a backbone of British communication. You do not want to be bombarded by horror in your life, and yet that is somehow a false flag being covered up for. These regulations that, as you said, verbatim, are there for fucking reasons, and they are good goddamn reasons, and we'll see them play out as we go, but they are there, devised by smart people for good goddamn reasons. This is, as an institutionalist, I just...
Yeah, anyway. This is where you want institutions to actually do their job, isn't it, essentially?
Fucking right, exactly. Be smart.
He says they don't necessarily need to release videos of any carnage, just a sequence showing who was in the foyer and where they were situated immediately before the alleged explosion would go some way to establish whether they told us what is true. That exists. That footage exists. You can see CCTV footage right up to before the blast. So that is covered. And that's not my criteria. That's Richard's criteria. So by Richard's criteria, that bit of evidence now exists. And here's the other thing, right, Kate? There is gory footage. There was gory photos found on Chris Parker's phone. There's some like the bloody shoe, and there's the Abby Mullin. Abby Mullin basically put out a statement saying, I've just waded through blood and shit and stuff like this, and showed gore on her handbag and in her hair and blood spattered up her and stuff like that. And she got pilloried for it. Like, and she had to defend herself, saying, look, I'm just trying to process this information.
Why?
Well, because it's the same thing, because everybody was really sort of like, but this is why you've not seen it. Because like, even on gore sites and stuff like that, it would be one of those things where it's beyond the pale, this, the dead children. No newspaper would touch it. And if you put it up on your Facebook or your social media, you'd be attacked. So this idea that basically there's no publicly available images and stuff like that, he's right, in as much as there was none taken by concert goers that show dead people that have been released to the public. According to the inquiry, there are some, and they've said they're never going to release them to the public.
They're sealed?
Yeah.
Just fair enough.
Fair enough.
Right, okay. Now, you could say, well, of course, to say that's a lie. But also, he forgets the fact that basically in the John Barr footage and in the Chris Parker photograph, you can quite clearly see the Polish gentleman, Klis, lying there dead. You can see the top of his head. In fact, there's numerous people that if you actually bother to pour over the... If you want to be really grim about it and like follow the inquiry and look at the photographs and stuff, you can see other people and recognize their dead bodies in the pile.
Which I'm not going to, but it's annoying that someone wants me to.
I did to a degree because I wanted to see.
Oh, brother, I'm sorry.
No, like, you know, and it is accurate. The stuff that they go about in the inquiry matches the footage and you can go, oh, that's her, isn't it? Okay. Now, if people want to be bothered to do that, that's up to them. I'm not highlighting the dead people, dead children in a photograph, okay? But you can't have it both ways. Either there's no footage or the footage is fake. Okay.
Respect to you, just for a moment, just respect for the listeners at home that you have poured through this, and whether they trust you or not, fair enough, but those who do, just know that you had to go through something shitty to deliver this episode.
Oh, this was not a fun one.
You've done great research every time, and I always am in awe of your research skills, because as someone who does my own podcast, it's always a pain in the ass, but I've never gone quite that far. And I just want to tip my hat to you and also give the listeners at home just a moment to just reflect on the fact that you've kind of walked into a mangrove and you've hurt your feet on some spikes, because that is some shitty, shitty place. It's a shitty place to walk into. I respect that. Thank you for doing this, because I think this deserves air, but fuck that, man. I'm even broken.
Hey.
Thank you.
We've been doing this one for about 4 months, I think, now.
Yeah, this took a long time, this one.
4 or 5 months.
Because we wanted to get it absolutely right. And it was not a fun one at all, by any stretch of the imagination. Like, so But this is the thing. And like, you know, he makes the point about why people have not taken photographs and stuff like that. They're children running away from a bomb, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was recently involved in a thing that is before the courts right now, so I can't say much. But what I can say is the footage that I took of the incident as an IT person who knows the way around a device was a fraction of what I thought it was. And the moment of cowardice where I pulled the stop button was way before I thought it was.
Yeah.
It's still going to be sufficient to the case if he doesn't plead guilty. And as I say, before the court's going to leave it alone. But as an adult, I still struggle with this. So just know that, like, whoever at home is thinking I would have done differently, you don't know until you do. And the situation I was in was just a person assaulting a woman in the street.
Yeah.
And I still freaked out.
Yeah, of course you did.
I was shaking.
Yeah.
I was shaking.
I always forget. I've got a phone in my thing. I'm always like, where's the phone? Where's the phone? You've got one in your hand. Where's the camera? Sorry.
There was another There was another man who was actually chased down by him, who I'm going to use as a piece of evidence, who said, I'm going to shove that phone up your ass, but he didn't actually press record.
Huh.
I did.
Well, yeah.
It's a wild thing. Every second feels like nothing. And it's a million years when you look back on it.
Yeah, it's
a mental thing. So anyway, I just want to give some perspective to those guys who are home, because all of this is so intense. And you've taken a bullet for this.
Well,
and thank you. This is investigative journalism that someone has to do. And you're not doing it on the BBC's dime. You're not doing it on Channel 4's dime. You're doing it because you fucking care about it. And I think that's respectable. I think, you know, I'm going to pin medals on your fucking chest.
Yeah, cheers, man. I appreciate that.
Yeah,
thank you.
This dive is—it's kicking my ass, and I haven't even looked into it. I'm just hearing it, and it's fucking killing me. So, thank you. Anyway,
also, the other point is that basically he contradicts himself many, many times like this, because he says there's no footage. Now, if you want to take the caveat, there's no footage taken by people. The concert goes inside the foyer. Okay, fine, fair enough. But there is lots outside, because we know there is, because he's talked about it and said it's fake. The girl with the blood coming out of the legs, the girl with the blood coming out of her hand, Ruth Morrell walking with the bolt through her leg. You can't have it both ways. Either there was no photographs, or there were photographs, but they were fake. When he starts talking about when Jenny Brewster says that there was a row of stewards stood in line stopping us getting through, but they were very friendly. And they said, your best way is to get turning around. You can get to the car park that way. And as I turned around, boom, we heard a loud noise. He's framed that as they're stopping people from going into the city room. They're not. Let's go over that paragraph very, very carefully. This isn't your best way to go, girls, your best turning round. Why is that? Because they were going to the car park and they were going the wrong way.
Okay.
Of course they fucking were. Of course they were.
Right? It's not best to go out across the Victoria Embankment. You go that way, straight down to the car park. That's it. But it's been framed in such a way that makes it suspicious, particularly when you attach it to the Freya girl. We were waiting to be let out to walk down to the foyer area. And while we was walking, no one would let us past. All of a sudden, we heard a massive explosion. Now, you'll notice, here's the thing, okay? Freya doesn't mention security. She's talking about the crowd. She's not talking about security. Again, it's been framed in such a way that it implies security are directing them in a particular way, which wouldn't be unusual at the end of a concert anyway, right? Now, actually, if you look at the Kerslake report, they were supposed to shut the doors and they didn't. They didn't. And that was a major error. Someone ordered someone to, and it was assumed that it had done, but it didn't. It just didn't happen. So the statements don't actually contradict each other. Furthermore, and I'm sorry, Freya, I'm not having a go at you here. We were waiting to be let out to walk down to the foyer area. While we was waiting, no one would let us past. As everyone spotted it, Genevieve Lewis would have spotted it. She's using impersonal
lots of
pronouns.
Yeah, here we go.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Isn't it? Which means either Freya's lying or Genevieve Lewis is full of shit. Now, I don't know what it is at this point. I don't want to spoil anything, right? Okay.
I'm going ladder.
But I spotted that actually they're cherry picking when to do these things.
Fuck your anal. That's amazing. The fact that you actually picked on that is incredible. You are the most anal attentive person, and you are the reason why this podcast is incredible. I'm just, that's it. That's all I'm going to give you shout outs for this. But like,
me. Yeah. I wouldn't have picked up on that.
Thank you.
Anyway, keep going.
According to the first-hand witnesses, the Kerslake report is incorrect. Shosek stewards diverted concert goers away from the foyer before the bang, not after the bang. It's like, no, they didn't. They advised people on the best way to get to the car park. And Christopher Wilde, who was a witness to it, spoke to Salman Abedi and then Shosek steward Mohammed Aghar just before the bomb actually went off. And the inquiry stated that the doors should have been closed, but they weren't closed. And so basically that's a misunderstanding of the order of events and taken different things and made them far more significant than they should be. Nick Bickerstaff, the man that was wandering around the arena and stuff like that, and Richard said this must have been filmed before the bomb went off. There's several reasons why that's completely wrong. One, if it had been before the concert ended, he wouldn't be able to get into that bit. He'd have been stuck in the foyer because he didn't have a ticket. The only reason he was able to get through was because of the chaos of a bomb going off in the foyer. So security would have had to have let him in without a ticket prior to that. And there's no indication that happened. Two, if the concert's still going on, why are there so many people in the actual corridor? Do these people not want to watch the concert? Do you know why there's loads and loads of people in there? Those people that are mocking him and having a go at him, you know why they're there? Because the concert's ended. Jordan Kenny, right? They spot him reaching for his wallet behind Nick Bickerstaff. Apparently he's not there with his friend Laura. If you watch that footage, he's surrounded by girls, surrounded by them. It's not clear who's with who.
So you don't know which one's Laura?
So which one of them could have been Laura? Also, Laura could just be 2 meters away. Who knows? The main evidence for it is that he's reaching for his pocket and they assume that that means he's going for his wallet to go and buy a drink. Let's say that he is. That doesn't prove that the concert's not over. He's just witnessed a bomb. Perhaps he wants a sugary drink or a shot of whiskey to calm his nerves. Perhaps he's not reaching for his wallet. Perhaps he's reaching for his car parking ticket or his keys. Or perhaps he's scratching his fucking nuts. Right, okay. You know what is also behind Nick Bickerstaff in the direction of the bar? All of the exits.
Okay.
So let's just Occam's razor it. Okay, and see whether it's more likely that this is filmed before the end of the concert or after it. Well, it's after, isn't it? And the main bit of evidence that he uses, right, okay, or one of the big ones is that the TV screens are showing the Ariana Grande concert being shown. You've been to loads of concerts. I've been to loads of concerts. Have you ever stood in the actual foyer whilst you waited to get drinks and been able to watch the concerts on the screens? Because that's never happened to me. Never, ever did they show the concert live feed in the bit where you could get drinks. You know why? Because then if you had shit tickets, you'd just stand outside and watch it on the TV screen. Right?
Exactly, right?
Everybody knows the trauma of needing a piss, needing a drink, or needing to nip to the cubicle for whatever reason in the middle of a concert, right? Okay. It's a pain in the arse because you're missing the concert. What they do show is advertising reels. So that's not the concert showing. That's an advertising reel saying, next week we've got Mudvayne. Week after that, we've got Peter Kay. Like, that's it. It's nonsense. Like, and actually, I mean, I don't know what this Laura girl looks like, but with Jordan Kenny, there is a blonde girl that's following him. But anyway, it's nonsense. It's making huge, huge assumptions.
And why is he assuming, why is he really assuming that he's going to the bar when, like you said, there's exits all behind him? Why is he not going to the exit? Like, that seems more Occam's razor as well.
Well, it boils down to give them the absolute 100% fairness. He said that he left the arena with Laura. And because they can't see or don't appear to see Laura there, there has to be another explanation for it. But it's just silliness.
The giving reasonable explanations always is good. Even so, you want to always give the benefit of the doubt to any of this stuff.
Hey.
I think that's fair. That is really fair.
There is one thing that's a fair point. Why did he not phone Ellen? Why did he film himself? And the explanation given by Nick Bickerstaff is that he was panicking and he wasn't thinking straight and he thought that he was going to die because he thought that another bomb was going to go off. And so he wanted his daughter and his family to know that he spent his last moments desperately trying to search for his daughter.
Yep.
Again, you could say that's part of a furnished narrative or whatever, but you also could say, but it's plausible. Now, Richard basically says that he thinks that he's a crisis actor. There's no evidence of that. There's absolutely no evidence of that at all.
Yeah, I've been in an acute situation. Must say, like I say before, I won't say too much, but something's before the course, but the delay that I had to record it was quite jarring. It is very troubling. And in that situation, you do have this sense of urgency, sense of finality of this is a moment, I must capture it, otherwise X, Y, Z.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
And that is fair enough.
Yeah.
To think otherwise is mental. But the thing is that also that moment goes back so much faster than you think it would.
Yeah.
Very, very fast.
And yeah, again, you're not thinking straight. You're in a fight or flight situation. So you're doing something.
Fight or flight big time.
And also in a situation like that, I know this sounds silly, but talking to your phone, it's occupying a certain part of your brain, isn't it? That gives you a degree of psychological comfort.
And nobody knows how they're actually going to react in any situation. That a lot of the people say, no one would act like Nick Bickerstaff. Yeah, why would you do that? That just seems, come on, you don't know. Nah. Nobody knows.
No, you don't know.
And that concludes part 5. Thank you for listening to Some Dare Call It Conspiracy, the Manchester Arena Bombing on Trial series. Tune in next week for part 6. And as always, if you subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/somedarecallitconspiracy, you can listen to the full 8-part series right now. Thanks again.